welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn. Hello from Stephen Crittenden. Welcome to the Religion Report. Today, as promised, we're reading Mark's Gospel, the earliest of the four Gospels and arguably the darkest and most cryptic. Mark's is the angry Jesus who casts out demons, curses fig trees, gives up trying to teach his disciples anything, and dies utterly alone. Oscar Wilde wrote about Jesus that his entire life is also the most wonderful of poems. For pity and terror, there is nothing in the entire cycle of Greek tragedy to touch it. Well, sociologist John Carroll certainly captures all of that in his new book, The Existential Jesus. He argues that Mark is one of the pinnacles of Western literature, and that Mark's Jesus is the great Western teacher on the nature of being, and that his real tragedy is that he ends up as his only student. Well, John Carroll has been a very generous teacher over the years that I've been presenting the Religion Report. John, welcome back to the program. It takes a certain kind of daring to write a book about Jesus, let alone a book in which you basically ignore two of the four Gospels, Matthew and Luke, because they're not very interesting.
Jesus is a creation of four stories. We know virtually nothing about him apart from the four Gospels. I mean, there are snippets in, you know, later supposed Gospels. The letters of Paul tell us next to nothing. There's virtually no independent historical or archaeological evidence. So he's a creation of four stories. The overwhelming consensus today is Mark is the first Gospel that was written. To me and great literary critics like Harold Bloom in the United States and Frank Kermode in England, Mark's is the pungent, powerful, great narrative of the four in any literary or narrative sense. And next to it, Matthew repeats about 80% of Mark and adds a lot more. Compared to Mark, he's long-winded, the narrative is jumbled and often incoherent, and it lacks subtlety and so of any of the depth and charge of the grand metaphysics that you become embroiled in once you get into Mark's Gospel. I think Luke is a lot more interesting. There are pieces of great literary flair in Luke, and he adds the parable of the Good Samaritan, the prodigal son, which no one else does. But overall, it's got similar weaknesses to Matthew. And in my reading, John is the one of the three who, they're all writing with Mark in front of them, he's the one of the three who really understood Mark, and what he does at his best is he provides a series of brilliant narratives to elaborate and extend things that are too cryptic or undeveloped in Mark.
Oscar Wilde described the four Gospels as four prose poems about Jesus. You're arguing there's really only one prose poem, Mark, and the rest are footnotes, and the best footnotes are by John.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
John, you mentioned the English literary critic Frank Kermode. His book on Mark, The Genesis of Secrecy, is one of my favourite books. In fact, I think it propelled me into the religion department at the ABC. Mark used to be seen as a pretty clumsy and unsophisticated gospel written in poor Greek. Kermode shows that it's very sophisticated indeed, especially in the way the narrative is structured. It's not meant to be understood naturalistically, but as a kind of puzzle.
Kermode's book has been more useful to me than all the biblical commentary and New Testament interpretation that I've read, and I've read a lot of that. And it is so for the simple reason that, you know, as you say, the surface text is in common or very simple Greek, but this is a story that works on its subtext, and it works through a very strange series of tactics where the subtext keeps undermining any understanding the reader thinks they gain as they proceed through the text. Now, the fall guys for the reader are the 12 followers or disciples who learn nothing. I mean, this Jesus finds out very early on that it's a waste of time trying to teach them anything. Now, a narrative that sort of works through enigma and dramatic paradox that
an keeps, allegory too, John.
An allegory and keeps ripping your feet out from under you, so to speak, as you progress, has to be read in terms of its own logic. And what Kermode is great at is the technique of this unique type of, I mean, I don't think there's anything else like it in Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
He made the 12 take a boat and precede him to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, to Bethsaida. He sent the crowd away, and when they had all gone, he left the wilderness and went up the mountain. It was evening, and he was alone. From on high he saw the boat in the middle of the sea, with the 12 struggling to row into a rising headwind. At about the fourth watch of the night he approached, walking on the water. He wanted to pass them by, but seeing him and taking him for a phantasm, they all screamed out in terror. He spoke to them, "Courage, I am, don't fear." He approached and got into the boat. The wind abated.
Jesus goes up on the mountain by himself. He's fed up with teaching the multitudes because he's sort of starting to realise that at that level he's a sort of vaudeville magician carrying out miracles and no one's learning anything. He's fed up with his disciples. He sends them across the Sea of Galilee. It's night. He goes up the mountain to be alone by himself as the 12 are rowing across the Sea of Galilee in the middle of the night. The wind starts to rise. Jesus alone is looking down and sees them becoming more and more fearful. I mean, that's a bit odd in itself, in that they're fishermen who've spent their lives on this very Sea of Galilee, and there's no indication in the text that their boat is threatened with sinking. After a while, he charges down the mountain and comes across the sea, walks the famous walking on water scene. He is in some sort of supernatural state. It's probably not very interesting to press what that actually means. These disciples don't recognise him. They think he's a ghost. They're terrified. I mean, plus the fact that right from the beginning in Mark, pneuma, or what's usually translated as Holy Spirit, sacred pneuma, the charged breath, the wind, the sacred essence, is what breathes through this story, pretty much replacing God. That's another issue. So in this scene on the Sea of Galilee in the middle of the night, there is also a sense that the sacred wind or the spectral wind is flowing down. No wonder the poor old 12 followers are beside themselves with fear. And the better they know him, the less they recognise him. I mean, in this scene you get the feeling that he's sort of some sort of supernatural monster in their eyes coming across the water. He utters at this point what becomes his central teaching. He says, "Courage, I am, don't fear." Now, the courage, don't fear, provokes the most extreme fear, and it's a sort of negation. And this often happens in Mark. If there's a charged saying on the surface, it will have exactly the opposite effect on those who take it in.
A very good example of that is in the empty tomb at the end. The young boy says, "Don't be afraid." And the last line of the gospel is, "And they ran away terrified."
Exactly. And in fact, this is set up, I think, in the dancing across the Sea of Galilee in the middle of the night.
Now, let's come back to this question of I am. The book's called The Existential Jesus. The central teaching, you say, is I am. What does I am mean?
Well, one of my arguments is that Jesus is the great teacher in the West on the nature of being.
Why is being the problem?
Well, he basically says being is the problem, and I think a lot of the contemporary world today would say, yes, all of the books and therapies and everything else that asks the question, who am I, what is the nature of the self, what is the nature of identity, if there is a meaning in why I'm here and what I have to do with my life, it's got something to do with finding out who I am. And Mark's Jesus would answer, yes, that's correct. Now, of course, once he said, all you need to know is I am, you ask the question, well, what in the hell does he mean by that? The first half of the story spends a fair bit of its time stripping away what the I am is not. If you want to ask who I am, it's not my family. It's not that I'm from Nazareth. It's not that I'm a carpenter or a carpenter's son. It's not, even to go further, and this is more harsh, it's not even that I'm a particularly a good man or a bad man. It's not to do with one's virtue or ethical character.
You say, in fact, quite specifically, Mark's Jesus is not a teacher of morals and ethics.
And this makes him particularly problematic, I think, for church religion. He's not an ethical teacher at all. He's just simply not interested in morals. He's interested in sort of being, in the nature of the I.
And when St. Peter says to him, "You are the Christ," He sort of snorts as though that's the wrong answer.
Exactly, and he even goes further and he says, the devil's in you, Peter. I mean, it's an astonishing charge. Because in what Peter is doing there is saying, you are the Christ, he is parroting Jewish belief from the time, which was looking forward to a Messiah, or in Greek, Christ, Christos, who would come and save the Jews from the Romans. So when Jesus asks the followers, who do you think I am, or who do you say I am, and Peter blurts out, you are the Christ, Peter's giving a formula. He's giving a sort of doctrinal reaction, and this is precisely what the I is not to do with. And in fact, Marx Jesus attacks that impulse in all of us, especially when we're agitated or anxious, and we want something concrete, we want something secure. We want to be able to say, well, I am X, Y, or Z. He's constantly cutting that out from under the reader.
John, in your translations in the book of various passages, you leave individual words in the Greek text untranslated. They're just left there in Greek so that we notice how often they appear, and also so they don't lose the power that's been taken away from them by the official translations that they've been given.
That's true with a number of I don't translate pneuma, sacred pneuma, which has usually come down as Holy Ghost or Holy Spirit with capital letters. That translation into English loses the range of Greek meanings of wind, breath, spirit. And probably equally important from my point of view, the word that's been translated as sin, and I think this is really where Christian churches and their translators have distorted this text. The word translated as sin from the Greek word is hamartia. Now, hamartia in its origins means a loss of direction, a bit like a spear throw that's gone wrong. Aristotle uses it in his theory of tragedy, which was well known in the time and place in which the Gospels were written, to mean character flaw. Now, translating that as sin moralizes the text. It's as if Jesus is constantly concentrating, as the Old Testament does, on transgression, sin, in other words, a moral language. My argument is this is not what's going on in the text at all. No, that he's much more interested in being that's lost its way.
Okay, now your careful attention to the Greek text results in two brilliant interpretations involving Peter. The first relates to his name, Peter from Petros, meaning rock or stone. And as we know, the entire Catholic papacy is built on a single line from Matthew's Gospel. You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. But you show how the greater storyteller, Mark, links Peter's name to the parable of the seed sown on stony ground. The name Peter is a put-down.
Yes, Mark is very harsh towards Peter. I mean, poor old Peter has done everything right and he gets everything wrong. The first time the word appears in the text is Jesus gives him, his name is Simon, Jesus gives him the nickname Petros or Peter, translated into English. Petros in Greek means stone or rock. When we come to the first big parable, that of the sower, which is actually a pivotal parable, the part of the parable that becomes clear that Jesus is most interested in is seed sown on stony ground. And what's characteristic of seed sown on stony ground is that there's not much soil, so it rises with joy the moment it's sown, but the moment, because it hasn't got any roots, the moment the sun comes out, it withers. Now, stony ground in the Greek is petrodes. In other words, it's the matter out of which Peter, Petros, is formed. So Peter is, of his own nature, stony ground. And in fact, it's a perfect caricature of his nature that he rushes in with joy and enthusiasm, but the moment any pressure or heat comes on, he collapses, he withers. And in this series of associations, Jesus has already healed a man with a withered hand. We've already been told what the metaphor of withering is to do with. The healing takes place inside the synagogue.
This is
church,
one of these
temple
juxtaposition episodes that help you how to read the story.
Exactly. And I think, in effect, in that, reading that episode carefully, Jesus is drawing, he chooses this particular affliction, the withered hand, and he draws the man with the withered hand out of the church in order to heal him. And I think he sets up this sort of two-way momentum in that there are people who are withered, but they need to be drawn outside churches to be healed. On the other hand, there are embryonic beings, i.e. Peter, who the moment there is any pressure on them, wither, and they actually belong inside the church. And soon after this point, Peter is given the role of church building, even by Mark's Jesus, not just by Matthew's Jesus.
This is at the Transfiguration. His response to the Transfiguration is, quick, let's build some churches.
This is absolutely in the middle of Mark's text, and Jesus is losing his powers. He's completely fed up. There's almost a sense as if he's almost going blind. He goes up the mountain, and it's a sort of baptism by fire. Suddenly he's shining in bright light. He takes Peter and James and John up with him. And Jesus up there meets big man ancestors Moses and Elias. Peter says, let's put up tents for Jesus, Moses and Elias. The Greek word for tent equally means temple or tabernacle. Now there's a black cloud which the voice of God speaks out of. Now I think the subtext here is Peter in his profane blindness reads the divinity as rain and thinks it's about to rain. So he wants to build tents to protect the three holy men from getting wet. Linked to that is the sense, of course, he doesn't want to look on the shining. So he wants to get inside, protect himself from Jesus. The moment he becomes anxious, Peter's reflex is to build a church, but also to build a cozy communal environment in which I am protected from the truths that I suspect that this man who increasingly terrifies me, the truths that he is confronting me with. Peter does not want to look on the shining.
John, I said before that there were two fine readings in your book that relate to Peter. The second one is of a passage in St. John's Gospel where Jesus says, Simon Peter, do you love me? And of course, there are three different words for love in Greek. But because we don't have the original Greek text in front of us, we tend to overlook the real drama in this scene.
This is the last chapter of John, but he's drawing out what is in Mark, and Jesus questions Peter three times, do you love me? And Peter gets pretty irritated by why he has to be questioned three times. The first two times in the Greek, do you love me, is agape, or selfless or sacred love.
Do you love me, agape?
And Peter responds, of course I love you, but he uses philos, brotherly or friendly love, or mateship love. So Jesus repeats it, do you love me, agape? Peter answers again, a bit agitated, of course I love you, philos, brotherly love. So in the third time, Jesus switches to philos, do you love me? In effect, he's shrugging his shoulders that Peter's not capable of selfless or sacred or higher love or whatever you want to call
it. So he downgrades it.
He downgrades it to brotherly love. And in fact, that becomes, and John's kinder to churches than Mark is. It's as if John sees how uncompromisingly hostile Mark's Jesus is to all churches. And John provides a role for churches. It's a role of service. And Peter's told to follow, and service in combination with brotherly love. This is a very important shift, I think, from Mark to John.
Let's come back to Mark. On your reading, Mark almost blows the whole canon apart, and it makes you wonder why it's even there. It's so subversive.
I think it was almost lost in the early years, and I recently suspect the reason it's tucked in as number two behind Matthew, and Matthew almost certainly comes later, was to hide it. I mean, the church gospels are Matthew and Luke. And Matthew restores continuity with the Old Testament, and he provides a whole series of lessons for building churches, sort of a handbook for building churches. And Luke produces the Good Shepherd Jesus, children's little Lord Jesus, who lays down his sweet head. The Good Samaritan Jesus is Luke's Jesus. Mark's Jesus is not at all like that.
An angry Jesus.
And solitary. I mean, it's hard to think of a text in which the principal figure is so alone. There's virtually no God in the second half of Mark's story. If we go from the Thursday night through to the crucifixion, he dies at 3 o'clock the following afternoon. He only speaks two words between the Jewish trial, you know, sometime the night before, and 3 o'clock the following afternoon. Two words you say to Pilate. On the cross.
Are you the king of the Jews? Pilate says to him.
Yes, and it's a question about the nature of the I. Mark's Jesus always responds to who am I questions.
And so Pilate says, are you the king of the Jews? And the response is?
you say. It's very difficult to know how to read that. I mean, I think in effect, by the end of the crucifixion scene, that's what he says to God, that's with a shrug of the shoulders, you say. And because the next words after you say are on the cross, just as he's about to die, my God, why have you forsaken me? And this underlines the fact that forsakenness is the condition of this crucifixion. There are no followers around the cross, there's no family, there's no one. And there's the strong sense that God's gone from the story too. So this, my God, why hast you forsaken me? I think is a sort of existential cry of despair. It's followed, we assume soon afterwards, by just a great scream, and then he dies. And then, straight out of the silence, a wind tears through the Jerusalem temple and rips the veil from top to bottom. This is the last manifestation of the power of Pneuma.
I suspect Jewish readers aren't going to like this book, even though this Jesus isn't really the Messiah. He denies, in a way, that he's the Messiah. This seems to me to be a reading of Mark that says the Jewish Old Testament, if you like, is just irrelevant. It's superseded.
There are two sides to that. The first side is yes. I mean, Mark starts with the word arche, meaning foundation or in the beginning. And he very deliberately cancels Genesis in the Old Testament, which has God creating everything. The real creation is the story that I'm about to tell of Jesus. And this Jesus basically ditches ethical religion, the Ten Commandments, ritual religion, virtually all the elements of Jewish religion.
And of course, later, frowns very much on the temple.
Yes, late in the story, in the last week, as they're walking up from Bethany up the hill to Jerusalem above, he says that if you trust, you will be able to pick up this mountain and throw it into the sea. Well, that's usually been taken metaphorically, but this mountain explicitly there, and I think this is even more than subtext, is the Jewish temple. He's basically saying that what I'm doing is going to throw the culture of the Jews into the sea. On the other side, however, there are key distinctions in Mark's text, and particularly between insiders and outsiders. There's no distinction between Jews and non-Jews. The people who respond to this Jesus, some are Jews and some are not. And perhaps even more importantly, Jewish religion, the synagogue, is taken by Mark as a prototype for all religion. It's anti-institutional religion, and it's anti the culture that comes before, but it's not anti-Jewish.
Just one other thing about the temple. I must get you to tell, this is one of those absolutely pivotal allegorical moments where Jesus comes into Jerusalem and visits the temple and walks around and walks out again. And then you get the story of the withering of the fig tree, and we're back to withering again.
One of the most powerful and enigmatic moments in any of the Gospels is the next morning after coming into Jerusalem. As he's going up the hill, he sees a fig tree, and the implication is he's hungry, but there isn't any fruit because it's the wrong season. The fig tree's got green leaves, but it doesn't have any figs. So he curses it. The next day, as they're going past it, it's withered from roots upwards, and predictably enough, it's Peter who says, "Oh, look, Master, the tree has withered." I think this is an overdetermined image. It's the most obvious reading. This is the Jewish temple, which he's in fact about to empty, that's the withered tree and it's never going to fruit again. The second reading is it's his followers led by Peter, that we've had withering, as we've talked about, throughout this text and particularly identified with Peter. So Peter's the withered fig. But principally, it's the cross. And poignantly, in 3 or 4 days' time, this is a black stump that Jesus is about to be nailed to. And as much in the 20th century we've had this imagery from the First World War and T.S. Eliot of the wasteland, Mark's Jesus is someone who lays waste to everything. This is an image of laying waste to nature. From laying waste to nature, he's about to go up the mountain and lay waste to culture and basically leave nothing apart from 3 hours of darkness with him nailed to a black stump.
On ABC Radio National, Radio Australia, online and on your pod, this is the Religion Report, and my guest is John Carroll. His new book is The Existential Jesus. John, let's talk about some of the other peripheral characters in the Gospels. Pontius Pilate is someone you have a very positive reading of.
Mark's account of Pilate is very brief, but it's clear that Pilate is intrigued by Jesus. He knows the charges are trumped up, and by the end of the story, he's actually starting to know something. Now, this is a case where John, in a, I think, a brilliant piece of narrative, develops Pilate into a major figure with the famous question, "What is truth?" And coming out before the Jewish crowd screaming to crucify Jesus, "Behold the man," which the Greek, by the way, could just as easily be translated, "Know the man." Actually, Pilate's on the edge of really getting it. He's a sort of borderline I am. He's in transition to getting it, and he ends the episode with this very strong statement, "What I have written, I have written," almost as if he's writing the gospel himself.
Judas is anti-Numa in your reading.
Judas is the one of the 12 in Mark's story who understands Jesus and understands principally that he does not have the I am essence. He understands basically that I am not, to use that language. I mean, this is a theory of evil. I mean, it's actually quite different to most of Western theories of evil, including church theories of evil, which are linked to excessive desires or sort of rampant passions. This is a being theory of evil, and I think it's a far more profound...
And Judas is anti-being.
He's anti-being, and Judas, unfortunately for himself, understands too much. He wants to be Jesus, obviously. It's an envy situation.
Okay, John, you've given Jesus back to non-believers, but what can the churches possibly be expected to make of this book?
Well, I would hope, given the fact that they're struggling and the times, in most senses, sociologically speaking, are post-church or anti-church, that they'll take seriously an argument that says that why you've failed is that you fail to retell the great story that you've been given, and that if you manage to start retelling this story, then you will engage with people in
contemporary
people in
readers.
Our times, because this actually, for the modern West, this is the great story, I think, even more than the great Greek tragedies.
Well, I mean, imagine, let's come back to the reason you wrote the book, though. I imagine one of the things you're hoping people who read your book will do is go back and read Mark. But what are you hoping they'll do then? Are you hoping they'll go back to church? I mean, that sounds like a stupid question after this conversation, but what are you hoping they'll do?
I don't know. I mean, I've been, as best I can, a servant of this text, trying to retell it and interpret it in a way that will speak today. What happens then? I don't know. In fact, I don't even know with my... I'm still sort of submerged in the text. I
mean, tell me about the reading group that you're part of at La Trobe University that's been reading over several years now St. John's Gospel and St. Mark's Gospel. What effect has it had there?
Well, this book started from the reading group, which has been running for, or ran actually, it's now finished, ran for 10 years, which read a book from the Old Testament and the New Testament alternately at a time, a chapter a week. It was a group of 7 changing membership. In 10 years, we twice read Mark and we twice read John. Extraordinary thing happened on both occasions with Mark and with a largely different group, that it was like becoming absorbed in this extraordinary, completely encompassing, cryptic narrative, which possessed most of the members of the group are secular, by the way. Maybe there was one practicing Christian or 2 practicing Christians. So, you know, it's a pretty irreverent group. But after Mark, and this happened both times, everything else would disappoint. It was like joining some sort of sect, but without any doctrine and without anything binding the group together, apart from this sort of perplexed euphoria that came from struggling through this extremely enigmatic text.
John Carroll is Professor of Sociology at La Trobe University, and his new book, The Existential Jesus, is published by Scribe. Well, thanks this week to John Diamond and Noel Debien and to James Carlton for the reading. You can get a transcript of the program on our website at abc.net.au/religion. Thanks to our producers, Noel Debien and John Diamond. I'm Stephen Crittenden. We'll see you next week.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National, on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.